John Bachman, who pierces people's face. The K is for the kill, L is for the lover, and the M is for the mutiny, and I wish it didn't happen.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my drum?
Now the N is for not, oh no, my phone's just sinking. The B is for the peg leg that keeps me standing up. A Q is for quantum leap, R is for the rum, and the S is for the scurvy, which I wish I didn't get.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg.
That's underneath my boat. And B is for Mukitas, who plays a sour note. W is Tiasis, X marks a spot. Why? Cause I'm a pirate.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my grog?
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 88.1 FM from the heart of occupied Washington. We are news from the front line. We can be reached at WSQTRadio@hushmail.com, WSQTRadio@hushmail.com.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org for Thursday, May 12th, 2011. B'Tselem's report into Israeli human rights conduct in the Jordan Valley and Dead Sea Shore area of the West Bank highlighted a number of areas of concern. The report, released today, stated that the Palestinians were excluded from 77.5% of the area through Israeli legal designation of the areas as state lands, nature reserves, and military firing zones. The report particularly criticised the discriminatory policy of diverting Palestinian water reserves to Israeli settlements, giving individual Israeli settlers considerably more access to water. The group's research also noted the illegal exploitation of other natural resources in the area by Israeli companies, such as the Dead Sea Minerals by its cosmetics company Ahava, as well as Israeli control of tourist sites in the area. The report concluded that Israel has instituted in this area a regime that intensively exploits its resources to an extent greater than elsewhere in the West Bank, and which demonstrates its intention, the de facto annexation of the Jordan Valley and the northern Dead Sea area to the State of Israel. According to the Jerusalem Post, top Fatah official Abbas Zaki has warned that Palestinians may launch a third intifada on the upcoming Nakba Day on May 15th. Zaki warned that Palestinians may be inspired by the events that have recently rocked the Middle East to launch a third mass campaign against the Israeli occupation in the event that they have become disillusioned with peace talks. However, Fatah leader Mahmoud Abbas has claimed that the second intifada was a disaster for the Palestinian nation, and he would not accept a third one. The Israeli military has increased its presence across the West Bank in anticipation of the Al-Nakba commemoration. The Israeli military has given the go-ahead to demolish the homes of seven Palestinian families in the West Bank town of Al-Walajah. The statements delivered to the families say the homes will be demolished within 48 hours as they do not have official construction permits from Israel. Al-Walajah town will soon be entirely annexed from much of its farmland and from the Palestinian territories with the completion of the Israeli separation barrier in the area. Al-Walajah village was illegally annexed by Israel in 1949, but the residents were not regarded as Jerusalem residents and were never granted Jerusalem IDs. while the military does not grant the residents construction permits for homes and their facilities. Man News Agency has reported that Mahmoud Abbas will head the new interim unity government in the run-up to the fresh elections in 2012. The position of prime ministership was said to be a controversial issue between Fatah and Hamas in their reconciliation talks. Hamas leader Ismail Haniyeh has said to share the vice presidential position with another Fatah member. Delegations from both parties are said to be meeting in Gaza next week to discuss means of implementing the unity deal. Turkey has come out in support of the new Hamas-Fatah unity government and the creation of an independent state of Palestine, and said that it will extend financial support to the Palestinian Authority. In a television interview on Wednesday night, Turkish Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan stated that he did not believe Hamas was a terrorist organisation or a hindrance to peace in the Middle East. He added that Hamas is a resistance movement trying to protect its country under occupation. That's all today from the IMEMC. This was Thursday, 11th of May's daily roundup of news from the occupied Palestinian territories. We hope you will join us again tomorrow. This was brought to you by me, Kevin Murphy, and Hussam Cassis.
On May 4th, Fatah, the Palestinian faction that rules the West Bank, and Hamas, the Islamist faction that controls Gaza, signed a pact in Cairo that would unite the two rival parties to form a transitional government and hold long-delayed elections in both territories within a year. Because Hamas has refused to renounce violence or recognize Israel's right to exist as a Jewish state, Israel condemned the move, while the Obama administration is taking a wait-and-see approach. The Palestinian Accord puts at risk hundreds of millions of dollars in U.S. aid for Fatah's Washington-supported Palestinian Authority in the West Bank, since the U.S. considers Hamas a terrorist organization and could refuse to fund any government that they are a part of. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Chris Tenzing, longtime editor of Middle East Report, about the Palestinian Accord. He says the reconciliation was a response to the grassroots Palestinian demand to end the debilitating division that presented a major obstacle for the resumption of meaningful negotiations with Israel. The pact also sets the stage for an effort to pursue international recognition of a Palestinian state at the United Nations this September. Tenzing addresses how the U.S. and Israel are likely to respond to Hamas and what Hamas and Fatah both hope to gain from this new arrangement.
I would say Israel and the U.S. are setting up hurdles for Hamas that Hamas cannot jump over, and I think Israel and the U.S. know that. Specifically, the hurdles are the so-called quartet conditions that were put in place, I believe, in 2006 as conditions for Hamas to join the U.S.-sponsored peace process alongside other Palestinian parties, and those conditions would be acceptance of previous agreements that Palestinians have made with Israel, the Oslo Accords, and so on, renouncing all forms of violence, and accepting Israel's right to exist as a Jewish state. And Hamas is not going to give a firm answer one way or another to either of those conditions. On the question of violence, Hamas will say that they offer a long-term ceasefire, which, of course, they have done in the past and have observed in the past, largely without incident, not completely, but largely. And that's for the reason that Hamas does not want to appear to Palestinians as being sort of unilaterally disarming in the conflict. And since Hamas has won a large part of its current political support from Palestinians, even those who are not Islamist, on the strength of resisting what Palestinians see as Israeli aggression against them, then Hamas could not sort of appear to be laying down its arms without some kind of promise of the same from Israel. And then with regard to the second question of accepting Israel's right to exist as a Jewish state, that relates to the right of return for Palestinian refugees, also the future status of Palestinian citizens of Israel, who Hamas or Fatah, for that matter, as leaders of the Palestinian people as a whole, consider themselves in some representative relationship to. So the idea there is that they don't want to appear to be sort of saying that any agreement with Israel is now and forever to forestall any unification of the Palestinian people and the diaspora in the lands from which those people were expelled in 1948. It's very unlikely that Hamas will, you know, agree to those things. And so since they're not going to agree to those things, that largely drowns out the news, which is that, you know, Khaled Mashal, the spokesman of Hamas based in Damascus, has stated very clearly this time, with no sort of ambiguity whatsoever, that Hamas will recognize the pre-1967 borders as the provisional borders of an Israel and a Palestine, with Jerusalem as the capital of Palestine, and with settlements in the West Bank removed and no land swaps. I mean, it was a very clear statement that Mashal made. So basically, Hamas is going a considerable distance further, in fact, than they have gone to date. And the response so far of Israel has been to reject the agreement, and the response of the United States has been wait and see, but keep the existing blockades and so on in place.
It's a pretty big financial gamble for Abbas to risk millions in U.S. support. Even if the Obama administration is taking a wait and see attitude, I can imagine members of Congress moving to cut funding, you know, pretty much immediately. Do you agree?
I'm sure that they do regard it as something of a gamble, but I think they probably think that it's a gamble they had no choice but to make. The alternative to make no attempt on the Palestinian side to set the agenda or seize the initiative would be to leave the status quo to fester. And the status quo is untenable for the Palestinians. The best that the Palestinians could hope for under Netanyahu or under a successor government led by the Kadima Party, the, you know, what is now called the centrist party in Israel, which is leading in most of the polls that are taken, the best that the Palestinians could hope for would be a unilateral Israeli declaration of a Palestinian state based on provisional borders, which would have no guarantees about any of these so-called final status issues, in which Israel would retain all sorts of rights and all sorts of impingements upon Palestinian sovereignty. And that just would essentially be basically a legalization of the status quo. So if the Palestinians are going to have any measure of real sovereignty, they have a considerable obligation here to try to set the agenda on something closer to their own terms. And that's what I think they have done. And we can't leave out the popular pressure either, which is a very important factor. And in the broader environment of the Arab world, in the wake of the Tunisian Revolution and the Egyptian Revolution and the outbreak of popular uprisings across the Arab world, including Syria and other countries, and mass protests in Jordan and countries very close to Palestine with large Palestinian refugee populations, there was a great deal of pressure on the Palestinian leadership to put aside their own differences, which were considerable, and try to work together toward a common national goal.
That was Chris Tenzing of Middle East Report. Find a link to the latest reports on the Israel-Palestine conflict at our website at btlonline.org.
Afghanistan, Monday. NATO is reporting the death of an occupation soldier from an IED attack in an undisclosed location in southern Afghanistan. Afghanistan, Tuesday. The Romanian military is reporting the death of a Romanian occupation soldier from an IED blast in Zabul province, Afghanistan. Afghanistan, Tuesday. The French Ministry of Defense is reporting the death of a French occupation soldier from an IED blast in a target valley, Kapisa province, Afghanistan. Some news reports identify him as a French Navy corporal. Afghanistan, Tuesday. NATO is reporting the death of a second occupation soldier from an IED blast at an undisclosed location in eastern Afghanistan. Sirkhad District, Afghanistan, Thursday. A 12-year-old girl named Nilafar was killed along with her uncle by NATO troops when they raided the wrong house. They mistook her uncle for the Taliban commander. This was the third time this has happened in Sirkhad District in the last 18 months. Oops! Afghanistan, Tuesday night and Wednesday. About 100 Taliban fighters on motorcycles attacked a northern Afghan village involved in a government-sponsored local police program, killing a villager and 17 Taliban fighters. The Tuesday evening attack sparked a gunfight that raged intensely for 2 hours and then continued with sporadic shooting until just before dawn on Wednesday, said Abdul Aziz Gayat on Wednesday, the police chief for Jiaxing Province. Quote, they targeted Abdurrahman village. The people there plan to join the local police, and the Taliban had heard about this plan, Gayat said. The villagers in Abdurrahman fought to defend off the attack themselves until reinforcements arrived in the form of Afghan police, army, and NATO air support, Gayat said. The end of the fighting. One villager and 17 militants have been killed, he reported. Nuristan Province, Afghanistan, Tuesday. An estimated 400 insurgents launched a large-scale attack against police in Afghanistan's remote Nuristan Province, a part of the country that is largely controlled by the Taliban, officials reported. Provincial Police Chief General Shams-ul-Rahman Zahid said about 400 Taliban fighters were involved in a dawn attack, targeting checkpoints around a base housing police reserve units located about 11 miles south of the provincial capital of Paran. Zadar City, Baghdad, Iraq, Wednesday. Five Iraqi civilians were injured in a bomb blast in eastern Baghdad's al-Zadar City on Wednesday, according to a security source reporting to Aswa al-Iraq News Agency. Baghdad, Iraq, Thursday. Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki said he may extend the December 31st withdrawal deadline for U.S. occupation troops if at least 70% of Iraq's political leadership backs the idea. Only thing is, Iraq is being rocked by huge protests demanding the deadline be honored, and Muqtada al-Sadr has warned that he will reactivate his Mahdi army and his supporters will return to the battlefield of armed resistance if U.S. troops stay. Mr. Barack Obama, you got what you came for in Afghanistan. Iraq had nothing to do with September 11th. Now is the time to pull the plug, bring all the troops home today.
And no amount of money you could give me, honey, couldn't pay me. Ain't going back again. I ain't going back again. I ain't going back again. You won't see me back there again. No, you won't see me back there again.
Months before an elite U.S. military team killed Osama bin Laden in his hideout in Pakistan, there was a strong movement toward crafting a new peace formula in Afghanistan, including the Taliban, the Afghan government, and the United States. In the short run, the Taliban may have launched a new offensive against NATO forces, but sources say pressure will mount for a political settlement through a unity government as the U.S. war in Afghanistan approaches its 10th anniversary. The raid against bin Laden has placed added pressure on the Taliban to cut all ties with al-Qaeda, whose forces have little military presence inside Afghanistan. According to the Christian Science Monitor, movement toward a peace agreement includes Turkey, which is now allowing the Taliban to open an office in the pro-Western Muslim country, while Afghanistan and Pakistan initiated a joint peace commission. The covert American raid that killed bin Laden inside Pakistan has also put hardliners that block past peace efforts within the Pakistani intelligence agency, the ISI, on the defensive.
Suppose army recruiting ads had to have side effect warnings like drug advertisements on TV do.
The United States Army may not be right for every patient. Side effects can include distress, disillusionment, bitter resentment, isolation, traumatic and post-traumatic stress, sociopathic behavior, uncontrollable sobbing, uncontrollable violence, prosecutions for war crimes, prosecutions for domestic crimes, loss of contact with loved ones, loss of ability to love, brain injuries, blindness, depleted uranium poisoning, flashbacks, horror of death, horror of being away from death, loss of the use of limbs, loss of limbs, death, suicide, excruciating pain, the desire to feel excruciating pain, overwhelming rage and misery, loss of hearing, punishment by the army for failure to obey illegal orders, punishment by courts of law or by enemy forces for obeying illegal orders, torture, humiliation, shame, dangerous habits of blind subservience, or the wasting of what could have been the best years of your life. If you experience any of these symptoms, deal with it, sucker. You already signed your name on the dotted line.
It wasn't long after President Obama's May 1st announcement that a U.S. Navy SEAL commando team had killed Osama bin Laden in Pakistan that former members of the Bush administration and their allies celebrated the role they claimed U.S. torture of terrorist suspects had played in locating the al-Qaeda leader. Former Vice President Dick Cheney said that waterboarding, which was banned by President Obama in January 2009, was, quote, a good program. It was a legal program. It was not torture. I would strongly recommend we continue it. While the former Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld stated, quote, it was a mistake to rule out waterboarding. It's clear that those techniques that the CIA used worked. The motivation of former members of the Bush administration for defending torture is transparent, as their actions are considered war crimes under international law and as individuals could be subject to prosecution when they travel abroad. But apart from the legal issues, most interrogation experts agree that the only effective method of extracting reliable information from detainees is to use non-coercive methods and to build trust with suspects. General David Petraeus, who commands U.S. forces in Afghanistan and has been selected by President Obama to head the CIA, has asserted many times that U.S. torture serves as a major terrorist recruiting tool. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Gabor Rona, International Legal Director with Human Rights First, who explains why he rejects claims that torture is an effective interrogation method and believes that the abuse of terrorist suspects hindered efforts in locating Osama bin Laden.
The moment that the news, you know, flashed about the bin Laden operation, people from within the former Bush administration got to work to try to credit this to the policies of George Bush, and particularly the detention and interrogation policies of Bush. And there were a good number of reasons why they would want to do that. Of course, everybody wants their work to be shown in the best light. But when their work amounts to war crimes, and when they have to be concerned about the possibility of being prosecuted for war crimes, then they have an extra incentive to put a different face on their policies. And I think it's quite knee-jerk, and obviously knee-jerk, that the purveyors of torture policy in the Bush administration are the same people who came out and said that Osama bin Laden's death is attributable to these so-called enhanced interrogation techniques, torture. And the reason I think it's way too generous to call this thing even a debate is that what they're doing is simply making the allegation. And unfortunately, in today's kind of media slugfest, making an allegation seems to be the equivalent of making it stick. But if you listen to the details, and the details are already known, then you would come up with a very different conclusion than torture works. What we hear from Cheney and John Yoo and others in the Bush administration who were big fans of these policies is that Guantanamo detainees were subjected to waterboarding, which is also somewhat of a euphemism for suffocation. And when they were subjected to waterboarding, they later gave information leading to a courier that led the United States to Osama bin Laden. And if that's all you know, you would conclude that there was a cause and effect relationship between torture and getting this information. The reality is that people like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, one of the Guantanamo detainees, and another Guantanamo detainee were waterboarded many, many, many times over. In the case of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, 183 instances in the course of 1 month, and he divulged nothing about couriers leading to Osama bin Laden. Then, many months, something like a year after the brutal interrogations stopped and lawful interrogations took their place, that's when KSM, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, gave the information that led to the courier. So rather than saying that torture leads to information that leads to Osama bin Laden, which is how some would have it, it seems to me much more logical to conclude that torture actually impeded the ability of the United States to gain intelligence that would have led much, much earlier to bin Laden. And, you know, how many instances of terrorism could have been prevented if the United States had started and ended with lawful interrogation techniques instead of torture is the real speculation here.
Gabor Rona, maybe you could tell us a bit about the motivation of some of these former Bush administration officials who were involved in administering or ordering these torture techniques and what they've got at stake in terms of possible future prosecution here in the United States or internationally, so that they certainly have a stake in defending their policies that they were involved in vis-a-vis torture.
It does look like, at the very least, many of these Bush officials that were responsible for promulgating and implementing torture policies are not going to be traveling to, you know, Western European countries anytime soon for fear of being indicted and arrested there. However, the best information we get is that the U.S. government has made efforts to try to get some of those countries like Germany and Spain to back off these former Bush officials because it would be embarrassing for the United States, bad for Obama, for whatever reason. In the United States, you know, any time the Obama administration does something in connection with torture policy, some of these folks, like Cheney, like you, like Addington, Bybee, are not only ready and willing, but available and are called upon by the media in the U.S. to give their points and counterpoints, when instead they should actually be being prosecuted in federal courts for what they've done. And what they've done is nothing more or less than order and implement policies of torture, and in situations of armed conflict, that's a war crime, plain and simple, under international law and under U.S. law.
That was Gabor Rona, International Legal Director with Human Rights First. Find more information on Human Rights Group's views on torture on our website at btlonline.org.
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 88.1 FM from the heart of occupied Washington. We are news from the front line. We can be reached at WSQTRadio@hushmail.com. WSQTRadio@hushmail.com.
Twenty years ago, a swaggering D.C. cop shot and seriously wounded a Salvadoran man at the park at Lamont and Mount Pleasant Streets in D.C. When word got out that he had been shot after being handcuffed for public drinking, the entire community erupted. I was there 20 years ago. 5th of May, 2011, the community gathered in Mount Pleasant to mark the 20th anniversary of the uprising.
Here, we're now marking the 20th anniversary of the Mount Pleasant riots. Señores y señores,
and he was standing here, and you know the whole history, right? That he was drunk, and how the police said when they shot him, they set him up and put a knife on his right hand side. What the police didn't know was that I knew that he was zurdo, él es zurdo, él no está con la mano derecha. So I testified and I said, it is impossible, impossible for him to have a knife but in his right side because he is zurdo. He writes with the left hand. Okay, so, pero ¿qué pasó?
1991, the issue was flat-out police brutality and attempted murder. In 2011, there was another issue to deal with. The Chipotle on 14th Street, which fired all of their workers on just 30 minutes' notice earlier this year. About 100 participants in the ceremony marched in from that location after entering the restaurant, disrupting their business, and delivering thousands of petitions demanding back pay for the victims of their capricious firings.
We said it's hundreds of petitions, thousands of petitions, Latino views, the Latino workers were so hard at Chipotle, and they were thrown out like they had no humanity. They took our culture, they took our food, they used our workers, they threw them out and refused to pay them, and we told them we're not going to put up with that anymore. No mas! Chipotle!
No más Chipotle! No más Chipotle!
They offered them, they wouldn't give them $2,000 severance pay because they were fired in such a way, but at this moment they haven't seen a single penny from that promise.
I was saying that some things never change. We were just at Chipotle, that chain restaurant. There's one here in Columbia Heights that in a very indiscriminate way fired Latino workers. Without paying them salaries and benefits they own. This is a clear situation of discrimination and abuse. And I will want to ask you, all of you, to boycott that restaurant. Please commit to do so. We need to stand up for our community. And we need the solidarity of all, everybody here in Mount Pleasant. Thank you. Here in Mount Pleasant, the wealthy side always set the rules of the game. Here in Mount Pleasant, my friends, the dogs of the west side have better housing and healthcare than all the Latino children on the east side. The rest of us are just for those with most comfort, the rest of us are just a nuisance. Why the indifference? Why the classism? Why the intolerance? And why the wealthy gentry elite of Mount Pleasant can't stand the diversity in our neighborhood so present? They say they like foreigners and our food and our culture, but of course, as long as they live in another neighborhood, they worry about their quality of life, but not about that of the rest. They harass local restaurants and Latino businesses, throwing at them government inspectors because they disrupt their peace and comfort. Maybe they assume when patrons at Don Juan scream goal during a football match, perhaps they think they really mean let's riot again. They enlist the police in order to arrest pupusa and mango selling ladies because they lack proper permits. They also complain of another tamal peddling woman in the neighborhood because it's illegal and annoying. When the neighborhood is pestered with drug dealers and illegal real estate racketeers and other violent groups, why don't they openly meet with the rest of us? In order to find common ground and do their part to end with the divide. Well, otherwise, the less privileged of your children, my dear Mount Pleasant, are bound to revolt again, because it's natural for such an extreme wealth and opulence to exist so close to such extreme poverty and misery.
Congress, you've lots to do. Don't run our city too. We're citizens just like you and demand what's right. What gives you justly cause to rewrite our own laws? Who made you king? You preach democracy. Beware hypocrisy. In the free world's capital, let home rule.
On the 11th of May, protesters demanding statehood for D.C. and an end to GOP interference in D.C.'s budget marched out of Upper Senate Park and blocked Constitution Avenue, leading to what looked like 9 people being arrested.
Hey, hey, ho, ho, those D.C. riots have got to go. Hey, hey, ho, ho, those D.C. riots have got to go.
That being, of course, the budget riders, the social policy riders against the District of Columbia that the GOP has attached to the budget bill for the 2011 fiscal year and presumably will continue to attempt to attach to the 2012 budget. Before protesters swarmed out on Constitution Avenue and blocked all traffic, here's what some people had to say in Upper Senate Park.
And they think that, you know, we're going to do this and we'll slip in a rider and we'll go after the District of Columbia and we'll take away the Congresswoman's vote in the Committee of the Whole, and there won't be a consequence. And so what people have said is I want there to be a consequence, and I want to be able to, through my own person, express that consequence.
This movement is not going to stop. It's not going to stop when we get a vote in the House. It's not going to stop when we get budget autonomy or legislative autonomy. This movement will only stop when there's another star on the American flag that represents the people of the District of Columbia.
You heard that? People in D.C. are sick and tired of playing defense against GOP social budget riders and are going on the offense and won't stop for anything short of full statehood. Hey, Republicans, why don't you put that in your tea bag and drink it?
On the 9th of May, former D.C. school chancellor Michelle Rhee made the mistake of showing up at the Marriott on 22nd Street along with Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker
and Pennsylvania Governor Scott Corbett,
who was going so far as to promise to cut the school budget while spending tax money on vouchers for private religious schools. The event was funded by the so-called American Federation for Children, whose name is a direct jab at the American Federation of Teachers, with funding from people like the Koch brothers, who've been funding so many far right-wing and Tea Party causes, funding from Betsy and Dick DeVos, who are related to Eric Prince of Blackwater. And in fact, one sign there said that vouchers are to education as Blackwater is to the military. Not surprisingly, having this many Republican union-busting thugs at the Marriott drew enough protesters to entirely fill the sidewalk in front.
In my state of Pennsylvania, our governor has proposed to cut $1.2 billion for education. He says we can't afford it. He still stands up and argues for the virtues of tuition vouchers. He still proposes to spend money we don't have to fund them.
The billionaires who are pushing vouchers on public schools say it's about choice, but here's what someone from Milwaukee had to say about the effect of vouchers on choice in the schools.
And before vouchers entered the Milwaukee public school system, parents had a choice. We have language immersion schools. We have art specialty schools. We have IB schools and we have advanced placement schools. When vouchers came in, they did damage to all those choices parents already had. And now our students are left with art schools that only say art on the front of the building.
That's right.
There are no art supplies.
Ted Rock, Jared Ball, DJ Munch, Chocolate City, this is movement music. Have you heard the news?
Walmart's coming.
Georgia Avenue, uptown, ain't that something?
Something.
Small businesses, shop owners, hearts pumping, cause they know their livelihoods is about to take a thumping.
Thumping.
See, you can't compete with a superstore who's an importer of slave laborers. Craftsmanship, low price to flip to undercut the market, hand over fist.
Walmart
is infamous for the way they behave. Low wage pay, treat the workers like slaves. Employees who try to unionize, soon find themselves in unemployment lines. The way they treat women needs improving. 1.6 million sisters are suing them for being paid less than the male equivalent. On these issues and more, we can't afford to be ignorant.
Keep DC Walmart free. It won't benefit you or me. They ain't about spreading love in the community. They ain't about Chocolate City unity. Opportunity stops to make a buck quick. Suck up all your resources and then they split. They try to come across as if they legit, but really their motives are counterfeit.
This is the Funkinest Journalist with your three Walmart commandments. Step one, move in and crush competition by underselling. Step two, pay workers nothing and block unionization. Step three, take all that money, put it into the Walton Family Foundation, and turn that into political influence to protect yourself and make even more.
Walmart, it's not a good fit for Chocolate City. Let me holla black at you with the skinny. Important that you clearly understand and remember, DC doesn't work with the right wing agenda. The Walton families are big contributors to bigoted representatives and senators. Trent Lott, sinister, Strom Thurmond, similar, Confederate, state loving George Bush ministers. Oversee your plantation mentality, results in black and brown casualties. Statehood opposition for the district has been supported by Walmart's mischief. The D.C. Voting Rights Act was defeated, assisted via Walmart PACs, and now they want to come here to see their money stack. Stay up on the facts. Chocolate City, don't relax and fight back.
Keep D.C. Walmart free. It won't benefit you or me. They ain't about spreading love in the community. They ain't about Chocolate City unity. Opportunity stop to make a buck quick. Suck up all your resources and then they split. They try to come across as if they legit, but really their motives are counterfeit.
Keep DC Walmart free is an emerging activist group of DC residents stepping up to challenge the corporate big box invasion of Chocolate City. Walmart has plans to establish 4 stores in DC by 2012. Walmarts in DC will threaten small businesses, cause loss of more jobs than it will bring to the community, and lower the wage standards for all workers. To find out more and get involved, visit walmartfreedc.org.
4th of May, representatives from Walmart and their wannabe developer Folger Pratt. It's been a tough night of ducking questions and dancing around the District Department of Transportation's rejection of their traffic study.
You can summarize in 3 sentences what the D.C. Department of Transportation report just said. I don't think everybody...
I can do it in maybe 2 sentences. Basically, what it says is that in DDOT's measured opinion as transportation professionals, not enough information was provided for them to accurately gauge the impact of this store on the transportation infrastructure, transit, and they really think that because it's an urban setting, the metrics used in their study aren't appropriate or accurate and probably undercount the number of trips generated in a significant way.
Intersection.
Could you identify yourself?
Willie Bay. Baker,
B-A-K-E-R. Here's the intersection. How many additional cars are going to be coming here and here in the course of the day?
Georgia and Missouri.
Georgia and Missouri. Your count, your guidance on the corner counting cars, what's the additional spot?
I can look in the study right now, but I don't know that off the top of my head.
You didn't submit that?
We did. It's right here. I can look it up for you.
Give me the number.
The problems currently with that intersection has been failing or at a level of service D, according to this report, for quite some time. Our responsibility is to mitigate the additional traffic.
not come in and rework the geometry to make that intersection work.
You wouldn't build on top of a faulty foundation, would you? If you knew the foundation was faulty, you wouldn't put an addition on it, would you? I mean, I didn't mean to interrupt, but that statement made no sense. There's an inherent problem with that intersection. You know that there's an inherent problem with that intersection.
I'm just saying
the pure logic of building an addition on your home with a faulty foundation doesn't make sense. And I see this is doing the same thing.
Would you tell me how many additional cars come through this intersection?
I will look it up.
Tell us now. I don't want you to leave without telling us. Tell us how many. Please tell us how many additional cars you said are coming through here.
Why don't you keep going?
We can go on to the next question. I promise you we will not let him leave without that.
When he tells us additional cars.
It must have taken half an hour for Walmart Community Affairs Director Keith Morris to answer the question by reading out a claim that it would only be about 450 cars from the very study that DDOT threw out as flawed, said it underestimated the amount of trips Walmart would generate. In the meantime, it went on to answer other questions, like this one, in which a right-wing, conservative, presumably yuppie veteran insulted African-American neighborhoods like the one threatened by Walmart.
Property values more, what gives greater incidence to crime and vagrancy, prostitution, and drug use than an empty lot. My point is, Curtis Chevrolet...
I am in the neighborhood that is directly affected by the proposed Walmart. We are totally, absolutely against a Walmart in that location. In regard to the empty lot, it is always interesting for me, whenever there's a comment about a predominantly black neighborhood, that we always find derogatory terms in which to describe these communities. The Curtis Chevrolet site is a site that needs development. We want it developed. We want the white development there. There has been no instance of prostitution. There has been no increased crime. I live in the neighborhood. It's a very quiet neighborhood. It does not have a lot of traffic. There are nice, well-kept homes. We have a community not unlike communities on the other side of Rock Creek Park, commonly referred to as Western Park. We want to keep that community. We don't want a big box store like Walmart. The neighborhood cannot absorb it. It is not personally against you, Walmart. However, we will not accept you. And you do have some things that are going. There's a class action lawsuit against Walmart, predominantly people of color, because wages, because of hiring and firing practices. You do not have a good record. So when you answer, you sort of skate what is real. You don't give the full truth. There have been studies. There's a long-term effect, negative effect, of what Walmart does when it comes into a community. And these are academic studies that are not based on emotional input, but strictly information that has been gathered. You have nowhere to go in this country. You have saturated the country. You have put these communities out. You've killed communities. And you have nowhere else to go in the United States. So therefore, the only place you can go except abroad is to go into urban areas. There is no dearth of fresh fruits and vegetables in the area in which we live. We certainly would welcome some very nice input, but there's no reason for you to come in saying that we don't have access to grocery stores. We do. We have access to grocery stores. So we are a great community. We want to stay a great community. We want our children and grandchildren to enjoy communities growing in a very positive way, just the way that Folger Pratt and you, Walmart, would want your children and grandchildren to inherit. We don't want you here.
many things to say. I don't really know where to start. And one is that I grew up in Mississippi in several different towns, and I saw those towns utterly devastated by Walmart moving in. There was no room for competition. I mean, it just ate the town. So I just wanted to say that. But is there anything that we can say to the two of you that will make you abandon this project?
Yeah.
Yeah, there's. I would say to that, I understand the concern. There's been a lot of passionate people that spoke here, and it's because you live in the ward and have been long-term residents in the ward. But you have to understand, too, that not to
blah, 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 blah. Walmart. Always low wages. Remember that attempt to close the West End Library in 2007? The one where the required public hearing was held on the 5th of July, the day after the fireworks? Well, those fat pigs at East Bank have once again pushed legislation through the city council to let them close the library and build condos on the site, hopefully to include a new library in the end. Here's a sample of our own radio coverage of what happened last time after a second public hearing.
This is Dial Tone for WSQT Radio. Library closing alert. The City Council has passed legislation to sell the West End Library to East Bank, the same corporation that finances development in Georgetown. On Saturday, July 14, 2007, Joe Sternley, Vice President of Acquisition for East Bank, came to speak to the library. He was met with a crowd that had just been pumped up by an energetic rally outside, put together by Empower DC's People's Property Campaign, as well as some friends of the library.
Yes, sir. If indeed East Bank does not want to be secretive, then I take that to mean East Bank is for good government. As a member of this community, I insist upon a competitive bidding of ideas for this library site.
Now, with Fenty and the unwelcome spotlight he attracted gone, those fat slugs at East Bank think they can force the community to accept the closure of yet another library. Some community groups have given up and are settling for attempts to get concessions out of the deal. How about East Bank paying taxes to the city in excess of all that taxpayer money they will get to tear down a perfectly good library so they can sell condos for profit? How about we kick the rich off welfare and keep our libraries open?